again. Say you leave me, baby, 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 don't go long.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, August 16th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Bernadette Murphy. Bernadette has published 4 books of narrative nonfiction, including the best-selling Zen and the Art of Knitting, a narrative that uses memoir and reportage to explore the connection between fiber arts, creativity, and spirituality. And she came on the show a few years back to talk about that book. She served as weekly book critic for the Los Angeles Times for 6 years and is currently an associate professor of creative writing for the MFA program at Antioch University in Los Angeles, where she heads up the creative nonfiction genre. The daughter of Irish immigrants, she's a native Angeleno. Her essays have appeared in Salon, The New York Observer, Ms. Magazine, Climbing Magazine, The LA Times Magazine, Literary Hub, The Rumpus, and elsewhere. She's here today to talk about her memoir, Harley and Me, Embracing Risk on the Road to a More Authentic Life, published by Counterpoint Press, just out in paperback. Welcome, Bernadette.
Thank you, Barbara. It's really nice to be here. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you again. Let's begin, as we always do, and have you talk a little bit about the memoir and how it came about.
Okay, great. Well, I learned to ride a motorcycle at age 48, and I did not expect to learn, nor that I would like the experience of riding a motorcycle. I was researching a character for a novel, and I decided, wouldn't it be fun if this character rode a motorcycle? So I took a class at my local Harley dealer to learn how to ride so I could write about it authentically, and suddenly my life changed when I took that class. I tapped into this part of myself that had become kind of dormant, that wanted to go do big, scary, risky things that I didn't know existed in me. So all my friends and family thought I was having a midlife crisis. I started looking into the neuroscience and biology and biochemistry of risk-taking to understand what was happening and why was it happening to me now, and was this a good thing or a bad thing? And so that's how the book came about. It includes a cross-country motorcycle trek with a friend of mine who was a suburban mom like me, and we both took off and did this crazy thing. Then I moved to French Polynesia for 3 months and learned to outrigger, canoe, scuba dive, rock climb, ice climb, all kinds of stuff, to just experience what does it mean to live an authentic life. And for me, risk-taking apparently is part of my authentic makeup, though I didn't know it at that time. And why and how risk can be good for us as humans, particularly in life.
Mm. Well, I certainly related to a lot of what you were talking about with risk-taking and the dopamine, being a dopamine junkie. And so talk a little bit more about that, because that actually was my next question. I was so curious how the risk-taking idea really came into it. I mean, did you start with, you know, the idea that this would be a book about, you know, your trip, and then it became layered with this other thing?
Yeah, again, it came because so many people looked at me like I was crazy. And I started to wonder myself, was I crazy? And I needed someone outside of myself to confirm that what I was doing was not necessarily a bad thing. Because there was a lot of times when social pressure, familial pressure made me feel like it was a bad thing, what I was doing. So I looked into the scientific elements of risk-taking initially just to comfort myself and to be able to say, oh, you know, science has reasons that we might want to do this and it might not be all bad. As I looked into that, I realized, oh, readers might like to know this stuff too, and I'll throw that in. So the memoir is not strictly a memoir. It weaves together the science. So it weaves back and forth between this is what I did and what happened, and this is what science has to say about these things.
Yeah, I found it just all that so interesting and really love the layers. And early on in the book, you talk about the Shuswap, an indigenous tribe in British Columbia who would relocate mm-hmm. to shake things up so the members
yes.
would face new challenges and be forced to grow.
Right. And I mean, this is the truth about the human condition. We get to a certain age in our life, and we have established our careers. If we're going to have a family, we've had them. If we're going to buy a house, we've bought it. We've kind of settled down. And it's a stage of life where if we don't want to grow anymore, we don't have to. Nothing's going to force us to necessarily. Sometimes things do, but usually they don't. So if thriving and growing and expanding, we have to shake things up. And if life isn't going to come along and do it for us, we have to do it for ourselves, like that tribe in British Columbia acknowledges. They move every, 10, 12 years in order to shake up things and have a new experience on a regular basis.
And there's a name for the love of novelty or addiction to novelty, neophilia.
Yes, yeah, and that's it's not necessarily an addiction to novelty, but it's the kind of people who are who thrive on new and novel experiences. The opposite of that is neophobia, which is people who shrink away from and don't like new and novel experiences. They don't have to be scary experiences. They just have to be new and something that we're not familiar with. And all of us sit somewhere on the continuum between neophilia and neophobia. And it turns out I'm closer to the neophilia side than I realized when I started this project.
Are there tests for this?
Well, there are. You can go online, and in fact, in the book, I list a number
yes.
of places where you can go and sort of test where you fall on the risk-seeking continuum. And you can, yes, absolutely, there are tests for this.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting where you say, typically the best, you kind of compared relationships and that neophiliacs do well with other neophiliacs, right?
Yes. Well, who wants to be around someone who's doing crazy, risky things? If you're someone who's terrified of risk, that might be uncomfortable. But if you're with people who are like-minded, it can feel good.
Mm.
And you can encourage each other without without getting crazy. I think that one of the cool things about being a risk taker can be, it isn't always, but can be, that it's learning to exert control over the elements that are scary and dangerous. And I was rock climbing yesterday, and so much of the energy goes into making sure we will be safe, that the anchors are set properly, that you've got your helmet on, you've got your harness, you've taken every safety precaution possible so that you're not just throwing caution to the wind, but that you're able to exert some sort of control and power over what should be a very terrifying situation.
Now, did you know this about you before this trip and before this book? I mean, you were married for a long time. You have
yeah.
children. You had a pretty stable life.
I had a very stable life. I had a very suburban life. I'd been married 25 years. I had three children. I was a professor. And the part of me that had been a risk taker had been more present when I was a young person. I'm going to say, around 11, 12, in my early teens. I had been a competitive skateboarder and took third in the nation for downhill women's slalom at that time. But then the hormones start changing in women, and I started creating more estrogen, and estrogen turns us into caretaking machines. So under that blanket of estrogen, I started being more concerned with having a relationship, caring for the person I was in a relationship with, and having children, caring for them. All my energy was going in those directions, which is very common for women, whether we have children or not, because of that hormonal shift that happens that turns us into caretaking machines. What happened to me is I took the class on the motorcycle at the same time my estrogen level was starting to drop, and I became someone who is less interested in taking care of everyone else all the time and started to wonder, well, what would I like to do, and what are the things I'd like to experience? And the shift took place. That happens for all women, but for me it happened to coincide with a motorcycle, and brought attention to the fact that my base level, who I am, is someone who is more of a risk taker, and it was just the anomaly of the childbearing years that had shifted me into someone who was more interested in seeking out safety and stability, which makes sense from a biological standpoint, because then you're there to be to parent your children. But then when I no longer needed that in my life, it disappeared again.
Interesting. Well, this would be a great time to hear you read from Harley and Me.
Okay, great. So the piece I'm going to read, well, I'll just start reading.
Okay.
Okay. Up until this point of my life, I never felt a great affinity for motorcycles, never harbored the desire to learn. In fact, when my middle son, Neil, bought a motorcycle as a college freshman, I was furious, utterly opposed. I railed about the danger of accidents. But when I signed up for that five-day class and found myself sitting on an asphalt training range atop a 492cc motorcycle, I experienced a kind of giddy delight I had never previously known, ever. Add to that the loss of my last surviving parent. Heartrending, but also liberating. All parental expectations were finally buried with my father. Then there's the existential awareness of being the next generation up to that. No more buffer between me and death. This is it. What I make of my life is in my hands and mine alone. I do not want to die blaming others for what I haven't done. I do not want my final days stained with regrets. By learning to ride the motorcycle, I am also utterly bewitched, all but seduced into an affair with steel and leather and speed, an affair as surprising as if I have fallen for an unlikely man. James Dean with dreamy eyes, slick back hair, and an air of defiance. That is a part of the attraction for me, the fact I never knew I could feel this way. The experience opened the door to so many life changes. I'm glad I had no way of knowing what was coming. I might have turned back right then. My story of transformation, of skin shedding, is emblematic for many women. Women in midlife now face a set of issues different than our mothers did, and unlike what our daughters will encounter after us. Our uncertainties are different, too, from those that men face in midlife. Men might question their career choices or take up a new sport. Some will buy sports cars and have affairs. Others will turn to hobbies or activities that give them pleasure and distraction as they settle into a quieting season of life. Our mothers might have chosen to take on volunteering at a hospital, returning to school, or reviving a neglected career once the nest has emptied. My own mother didn't live long enough to face those choices, but I saw friends' mothers grapple with these options. Some were trapped in the rut of their own maternal role. They couldn't seem to envision a life apart from spouses and children. Even as a young child, I couldn't help but believe there was so much more for them to discover. But they aged, and in some cases went to their graves, with their inimitable, irreplaceable selves still suppressed under a thick layer of estrogen, trapped within societal norms and the need for acceptance. But for those of us in midlife, both those who have raised children and those who haven't, we might be asking ourselves if we wish to continue on the same path, now that our career has been established or the children have embarked on their own lives. Perhaps we're aching to try something new, or maybe we're questioning marital choices we made early on. How did I end up here? Weighing the chances of creating a better relationship with someone new versus working on the relationship we're in, or simply striking out on our own. Though the questions assume different guises, ultimately they are the same for all of us, mothers, daughters, friends, partners, women and men alike. Have we done with our lives what we'd hoped to? If not, what can we do about it in the time remaining? Now that the struggling stage of early adulthood has passed, how do we place ourselves on the path to authenticity? And how exactly do we take calculated risks that will make us feel absolutely, richly, uniquely ourselves?
Thank you so much. That was Bernadette Murphy reading from Harley and Me, Embracing Risk on the Road to a More Authentic Life, published by Counterpoint. So, you know, you go way into your marriage, and as I was reading, I couldn't help but wonder how you were able to write in such an uninhibited way. And you know, what you do with the worries of your ex, your children, people that knew you as a couple, relatives, all that. What do you do with that when you're writing?
I think I had faced much of that prior to the writing of it, although a lot of it was happening in real time as I wrote about it. I had already experienced so much of sort of the shunning from family members, from my ex, from people around me. It had already cut me to the quick enough that I couldn't imagine writing about it could make it any worse. And at that point, it's sort of freeing. You get to the point where I've already lost the people I'm going to lose because of this decision.
Yeah.
I've got nothing else to lose at this point. I must say, my kids were incredibly supportive. I have three now young adult kids. The book is dedicated to them. They've all read the book. They supported me and, in fact, have thanked me for showing them what authenticity looks like and helping them make choices that are not always easy, but that keep them staying true to themselves. And that is probably the most satisfying part of having done this book.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting because you go into some topics.
Yes, I do.
So when you had your kids read it, were you concerned with those particular topics? And we're not going to go way into those since this is like a drive time morning show and there's children in the car and little children, I should say.
Right.
So
I give credit to my kids for being adults and we've always had very honest discussions with each other. So I felt there was no reason not to be honest in what I was writing, knowing they would read it. I went out of my way to try not to be hurtful. I think it's possible to be honest about our experience without hurting other people whenever possible. And I tried to err on the side of generosity of spirit whenever possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you did. You definitely did. So let's talk a little bit about actually the process of writing the memoir. You also write shorter pieces. And
yes.
So can you talk a little bit about, and this is something that comes up a lot on the show, a lot, you know, having to do with content and context. And when you know when a piece has to be longer, you've written, you know, a handful of nonfiction books. You've written a lot of nonfiction essays and articles.
Right.
So talk about that, knowing which is which.
Good question. First, I would want to preface this conversation with saying that all the pieces that make up Harley and Me and my previous books came about like a patchwork quilt. I would make one section of it that might be a standalone essay and feel like I still hadn't exhausted that topic. So then I'd make another piece of the quilt. And eventually the various pieces of the quilt came together to make an entire quilt. I didn't set out thinking, oh, I'll go from point A to point Z, but just focus on each individual square. And so that is how it came together.
So did you publish the shorter pieces? Or
I did, yeah. As I was going, the first one came out in the rumpus called Don't Call Me Biker Chick. And that ends up being part of a section, not part of the prologue, but part of the first chapter. So I just started exploring different things. And there were a number of sections I wrote that I had no idea if they belonged in the book or not. For instance, I interviewed Henry Winkler, who played Fonzie on Happy Days back in the day.
Yep.
And I had a huge crush and fascination with Fonzie from the time I was a young girl. And I realized when I started writing the motorcycle that I didn't want to be in a girlfriend situation with Fonzie. I wanted to be Fonzie. and so I ended up getting to talk to him and interviewing him. And I wrote it thinking it was a standalone essay that had nothing to do with this book. And when I started putting the pieces of the book together, it just sort of slid, you know, into its own place beautifully. But I didn't know that about it when I was writing it. I just wrote the pieces individually and at a certain point realized there's enough material here and I'm still fascinated by this. I think this is a book, not a couple of knockoff essays.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I wanted to talk to you about structure and outlining and,
yeah,
and all of that, and if that was a part of this. But I would imagine at some point you had to figure out how everything went together and
yeah,
transitions.
Yeah, and especially weaving in the science. I had a lot of difficulty with that in the beginning. I did a tremendous amount of research, talking to scientists, reading scientific papers, reading scientific books, calling quotes. Then I had all this information on various aspects of risk, and then I had my narrative. And initially, when I would veer into the science part, it took on a different timbre. The tone of it became very dry. I was quoting people for big chunks, and it didn't fit together nicely. So I had to sort of massage that and work on it and figure out if I'm talking about, riding the motorcycle across the state of Iowa, which piece of science fits in here organically? And if I'm talking about outrigger canoeing in Tahiti, which part of science fits in there organically? So I actually had paper stuck up all over my wall where I knew what my through line was, what the narrative arc of my story was, and then I had index cards for the various chunks of science and just kept moving them around in different places till I could envision where they all fit.
Were there pieces you had to leave out?
Most of them fit. So some of them, I start becoming repetitive with the science because I might talk to 30 different scientists and they start saying the same thing because they all agree about certain things. So at a certain point, I had more people agreeing on it. In fact, I think there's probably a little repetition in here that I wish I had not allowed to stay in there, because at a certain point, they're saying, which is what a lot of psychologists told me, is that science has looked at where risk is bad for us. They've looked at all the ways it's pathological, but very little science has looked at the ways that it's beneficial. And that they are finding ways it's beneficial, but because not much energy has been put into looking at it, there isn't a lot of evidence for that.
Hmm. Are there tests for checking your dopamine levels and whether you need a supplement or whether you're going to just get into risk behavior?
I don't know if there are tests. I know there are tests to find out where you sit on the risk-taking continuum.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you are someone who does well with that. I had my blood taken in writing this book before and after riding the motorcycle to find out what happened to the hormones in my body when I ride a motorcycle. So you could probably find someone who would take your blood and tell you that, but it might be difficult to find that person.
Yeah, and so what did you find out? I mean, what did the test show
then? We were looking at three hormones in particular. One was cortisol, which is the stress hormone that we produce when we're under stress and scared. One was testosterone, which is sort of the guy, manly, strong stuff. And one was oxytocin, which is what all of us produce when we kiss or cuddle or nurse a baby, anything. When we pet a dog, we create oxytocin, and it makes us more loving and connected. And my theory going, as I was researching this book, was that as my kids got to an age that they were no longer cuddling with me because they were now going into young adulthood, and I was having a lot of problems in my marriage, that I was craving oxytocin and that the motorcycle was somehow providing that. And so we did this test. The gentleman who did it was an expert in oxytocin, and he had looked previously at oxytocin levels. And one of the ways he looked at them was he went to a wedding in England and took the blood of the main people in a wedding before and after the vows to measure their oxytocin jump as a result of the vows. So the bride was the one who jumped the most. Then the bride's mother was the one who jumped the second highest amount. And then the third was the groom. Well, my riding the motorcycle jumped my oxytocin level the same amount as the groom in a wedding. So there was something very fulfilling about realizing that there was something happening when I rode the motorcycle that was filling this part of me that wasn't being filled in other parts of my life. Okay. Interestingly, my stress hormone, the cortisol, went down, and my testosterone didn't move very much at all.
That's really interesting. It's interesting stuff. Well, don't go away, and all of you out there, stay with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more Bernadette Murphy. Don't go anywhere.
How many tears, my darling, must a girl let fall? How many years will it take to forgive me for it all? You see, when I took you for granted, I knew not just what I'd done. I was a fool not to see that you were the perfect one. I made some wrong moves, I won't deny. Went looking for love when it was right before my eyes. Now don't go and tell me that you found somebody new. I tell you, it's gonna hurt me more than I could ever hurt you. I'm gonna cry like a rainy day.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am here with Bernadette Murphy. Her memoir is Harley and Me, Embracing Risk on the Road to a More Authentic Life, published by Counterpoint. Before we bring her back on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of my guests and me. And anyway, let's bring her back on. Hey, Bernadette.
Hey, Barbara.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit more about sort of the nuts and bolts of memoir from, you know, the writer's point of view of putting one together. Did you sell it as a memoir? I mean, sorry, as with a proposal or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sold it with a proposal. Interestingly, so this was my fourth book. I used the same agent for all four books, and it was the longest proposal I've ever written in my life. And we rewrote it countless times before she was ready to go out with it. And I think in talking to her, what I learned was that the market has gotten so difficult in trying to sell memoir that what I had done with my earlier books, which I could in a weekend or a week put together a proposal, now took much longer, and she vetted like everything on it before we were ready to go out with it. So the market has changed, and how memoirs are sold has changed, and that unfortunately has made it more difficult for things to get published.
Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose the market is saturated, but isn't it saturated with everything at this point?
That's what you would think, but from what I hear, because I run the creative nonfiction genre at Antioch. So I kind of hear news about what's going on in that world, that long-form journalism, long-form essays, those sorts of things are still doing well, but that there's a bit of a backlash against memoir right now because we had such a huge explosion of memoir that some publishers are a little leery about it. So I think one of the things that helped me in this case was because it isn't strictly a memoir, it's more of a hybrid, that helped, but that because we've seen so much come out in the realm of memoir that I think publishers are careful about what they're going to take.
Well, you know, I do like hybrid memoirs, and I, you know, as well as learning about your journey and sort of being with you in this new discovery, I just loved all the research and all the science that you brought into the book. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe that's a welcome addition to the genre.
I have to say, all four of my books have involved a lot of research, and that I'm someone who, if all I did was write about myself, I'd start feeling a little claustrophobic with it. And so then when I can use my experience as a lens to look at a larger phenomenon, why is risk good for you? Or in the case of my first book, you know, how is knitting a spiritual experience? I just am using my experience as a lens to look at this larger thing. And that makes me more comfortable because I'm just someone who doesn't like to write about myself as, you know, all that much. Mm. Although you wouldn't know that necessarily from reading my book.
Yeah, it's pretty personal.
Yeah, it is.
Well, you know, speaking of knitting, and I still have Zen and the Art of Knitting. I love that book. I'd be curious with, in terms of, you know, blood chemistry and what knitting does for a person or a psyche as compared with, you know, riding a motorcycle. I mean, it seems like, you know, they're very different activities, and does one, you know, knitting close you down in a way so that you can process things and focus, you know, as opposed to, you know, riding a cycle that kind of expands you in so many ways because you're totally on the alert when you're on that machine.
Right. It's funny because when this book was coming out, I had just finished reading the galley pages for it. When Zen and the Art of Knitting went into ebook, and they sent me the galley pages for that, and I published that in 2002, so it had been ages since I read it. And when I reread it, I realized basically they're the same book, if you can believe that. For me, knitting was something out of the norm. It was something I didn't think I'd be good at. It was something that in some way scared me because I was worried I couldn't do it well and that it was more for wifey poo kind of women. I don't have another word for it. And that I wasn't that person. But as I did it, I started finding meditative and spiritual and creative benefits from it. that are the same as being on the motorcycle, which is being very focused, especially if I'm working on something hard. There's a meditative quality that comes while knitting that is the same meditative quality that comes while riding a motorcycle. Mm. And the sense of sort of being in the moment in a way that I'm not in other parts of my life. And it seems contradictory because knitting is so different and is the kind of thing that you expect, you know, someone sitting at home by the fireplace with a comforter on their lap and quietly doing this, whereas a motorcycle, you're out in the world and, you know, your life's on the line. Mm. But I found them to be somewhat similar experiences in that they got me to this core part of myself that when I'm busy doing and being in the world and participating in the larger world, I sometimes lose track of. And both of those were ways that I got back to that core.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah, I like that. Do you still knit?
I do occasionally. It's interesting. It came in very handy when my children were young because it was the only thing I could do that at the end of the day, I could show someone and say, I did this and it stayed done. It didn't get undone, you know,
yeah.
Like grocery shopping or doing the laundry or cooking the meals or making the bed. That stayed done, and it filled a part of me. So that need has morphed into other areas. I do occasionally still knit, but not as often as I used to when the kids were small.
Mm-hmm. So in writing the book and in teaching memoir writing, a couple of things. One is, how do you teach memoir writing, and how did teaching affect the writing of your book?
Let me address the second part, and I may have to ask you to remind me what the first part
okay.
was in a minute. But as I was working on the book, so I teach at this low residency MFA program, and we check in with each other, me and the few students that I mentor, on every Sunday, on what we call Sunday check-in, and we check in with each other and say what's going on in our lives and how the writing's going. So as I was working on this, I was sharing with my students, this is the process. This is what I'm dealing with. This is the obstacles I'm dealing with. This is how I can't kind of get the voice right for the science part and how I want to hit my head against the wall. And I'm reading tons of Malcolm Gladwell to try to be inspired on how to do this thing. And so I shared a lot of the experience of struggling with it and got great feedback, both just basic encouragement, but also suggestions on look at this book or consider this from the students that I was working with. So I was really grateful for that. And for me, one of the joys of teaching is to be in that community of writers where we are encouraging each other. And it isn't so much that, oh, I'm the teacher and I know and I'm going to tell you, but we're all in this together and I know some things and you know some things and let's share with each other because we could all stand to learn as much as possible about this craft. As far as teaching memoir goes, I mean, I just start with wherever the students are and what it is they're trying to do. I do try to get students to look beyond their own experience. In my case, I like to follow the hybrid formula. I bring in research. But I try to get people to think about, okay, this is your story. This thing happened to you. That's an anecdote. But how does that anecdote become something that informs other people about the human condition? What is the so what of this story? What is at stake for this narrator? And how does that tell someone who lives in Idaho something about what it means to be alive in 2017? How does this inform our experience of the human condition and dilate our soul so that I may never have that experience of living in Idaho in 2017? But you, through your writing, maybe take me inside that experience and now my experience is a tiny bit bigger. There's a theory of literary criticism called literary Darwinism, and the idea is that we read as part of evolution, that the more stories we read, the more we prepare ourselves to evolve, and we get to practice different scenarios through, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, through experiencing these things in what we read, and as a result, we become better able to handle things that might show up in our lives. And I think that's really important. So if whatever your memoir is informs someone else on how to walk through something difficult or puts them in a situation where they have to think, what would I do? How would I handle this? They get to rehearse these things that might actually be helpful as that person moves through the rest of their life.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, I'm really loving this idea of hybrid memoirs, and and that's one way to perhaps kind of to break out of the glob of memoir writers, where you have the personal story and you have something else going on, as you do with the science. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about that. For instance, say a person is writing a memoir about their marriage, or something that went on in raising a child. How might they look at how to bring in another layer, so that it does turn into sort of a hybrid?
Right. So they would have a few choices. One would be to turn to experts, scientists or other people who look into the subject that you're writing about. Mm-hmm. The other would be to turn to other people and get their experiences. So it doesn't always have to be the experts. And then in the art of knitting, I mostly spoke with other knitters to find out, what is your experience? Do you get this meditative state? Do you, and tell me about why you knit and what you get out of it. So it's not just about, well, this is me and what I do, but this is what other people do. The other option would be to talk to the experts in the field. Figure out, if it's about marriage, do you talk to other marriage counselors or marriage counselors? Do you talk to sociologists? Do you talk to people who are studying the nature of marriage around the globe? Do you do research into how in Iceland the marriage rate is falling dramatically and what that says? All that could help expand the story, so it's not just about you, but again, you become the lens with which we look at this larger question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I think that's great. So in working with your students, do you have them, I understand they need to know about what they're writing about, but do you have them write anything out? Do you go into synopses or outlines, or, how much do they need to know and really know before they write?
It varies from person to person, and I'm someone who actually does not write with an outline, though I do what I call a reverse outline. So I will write either a number of essays, or right now I'm working on a novel, and so I have now about 100, 105 pages towards this novel. When I get to that point, I start thinking, I better figure out where I'm going before this runs off the rails. And then I start laying over what I've already done, a reverse outline, to figure out what have I done, so I can figure out maybe where I'm going. This can also come in really handy if you've got a first draft of something. Say you've written a memoir, you've got the first draft, there's stuff about it you like, there's stuff you don't like, you're not sure that it's all going sort of on the same narrative direction. Then you can lay out, this is what I did, and then look at it as an outline, as though you're at the beginning stages, and you might say, that part really doesn't fit, maybe that doesn't belong here, or, there's a gap in this part, I need to fill something in. And the way I do this is I do index cards of, just one sentence on an index card to stand for every major sort of scene or section. And then I lay them out on a table and start moving them around. And it can be sometimes that if I mix them all up completely and start out from a different place, I realize I'm telling a different story than I thought I was telling. And then I can use that reverse outline to put it into place. I do this with my students a lot, where I have them break their stories down into these chunks, mix them up, and hand them to someone else. Let that someone else read it out of order, and then tell the student, this is what I think your story is about. And sometimes a light bulb goes on. It's like, oh my goodness, I had no idea that's what I was writing, but you're right, that is what my story is about. And now I know how to organize them.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I love that. What about revision? I mean, do you go on forever revising?
I ask
because it seems like, writers can continue tweaking forever. There's a major revision, maybe there's a couple of minor revisions, and then there's refining, and you could go over word choices just for years trying to get things better.
Yeah, and it's at a certain point, you're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. it's not going to get any better. You could keep changing those words, it's not going to get any better. So that's when we realize we have to cut this thing loose. Either it's ready to go and be published, or it's not working. And I've had that experience with the novel I'm working on now. I rearranged deck chairs on the Titanic forever before I realized it's not working. You need to recast this, rethink this, reapproach this from a completely different standpoint in order to sort of get freshness again. I know that as a writer, at a certain point, whatever I put on the page is like concrete. It starts to harden. Once it starts to harden, I'm not going to be able to do much as far as reshape it. It's too stuck in that form. And so I want to be careful that I don't polish too much early, because then it gets that concrete feeling. But once I'm sure that I've got the narrative arc right, the big strokes right, then I can go back and start doing that polishing, because that's when the hardening. And if the hardening happens, you got to break it apart. You got to take a jackhammer to it and break it down to its basic pieces again, and maybe, you know, see if you can reconstitute some malleability in the material.
And what about when a writer just says, you know what, I'm just going to just move on. I'm going to leave it behind and move on.
Yeah, and I think that's important. Michelle Hunnivan, who's a fabulous novelist, one of my best friends, and we wrote a book together a number of years ago, said that there's two kinds of novelists, and we could, you know, say this about nonfiction writers too. There's those who write 10 different novels in order to write their first novels, and there are those who write their first novel 10 different times to do it. I think in both cases, all writers go through that. Either we'd say, okay, that's it, I've had enough of that one, I'm moving on to something fresh. Or if you're like me, you become so obsessed with it, I can't let this go, I'm going to try it yet again. This time we'll make the character this, and next time we'll make her that. And we just come up with new ways to approach the same material. But generally, it's the 10,000-hour thing that Malcolm Gladwell talks about, how long it takes to really gain a skill, that we have to work at it so many hours to really get good at this business of figuring out how to write a narrative. So if you're the kind of person that can cut it loose and move on to something else, fine, stick it in a drawer. You might look at it 10 years later and say, ah, now I know what to do with this. Or if you're like me and you just have to keep hitting the same dead horse, then you try to find new ways to do that.
Two different types of writers, huh?
It's yeah.
Really interesting. We have a few minutes left. I'm curious if any surprises came out of this memoir for you.
Yeah, you know, I did not want to write a book about divorce. I really, really, really did not want to write a book about divorce. And the undercurrent in this book is that my marriage was falling apart. And part of the reason the motorcycle did what it did for me is that I felt so afraid of facing what I had to face with a divorce looming, that I needed the strength that I got when I sat on the motorcycle to be able to think, I can get through this. And if you had asked me, you know, just a year before I wrote it, would I even wade into that territory, I would have told you, no way, there is no way I'm going there. And yet, there it is.
Yeah, there it is. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't think we get to choose our stories sometimes, you know, that what this is the story that chose me, and as much as I would have liked to have shied away from that element of it, I don't think it would have had the same impact without that.
Yeah.
I don't think the desperation to do what I did would have been there without that element.
Well, fantastic memoir.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love it. Just two more things. One is, any two books you've read that you recommend?
Oh, gosh, that's a really hard one, because there's so many things I recommend. One is The Still Point of the Turning World by Emily Rapp.
Uh-huh.
It's a story of her son was diagnosed with Tay-Sachs at 9 months of age, which is a always fatal neurological disease, and he died just before his third birthday. And it was the story of her walking through that experience and how you find the core of who you are when you face really difficult things in life. It's absolutely beautiful. Another book. God, there's so many. Barbara, this is cruel. Tara Eisen's The Movie Book, Reeling Through Life, which is a collection of essays about all the ways movies formed her identity. She has essays in there called How to Lose Your Virginity, How to Be a Writer, How to Be a Jew, and all the different ways that the movies she saw at those formidable moments of her development helped shape her understanding of what it meant to be a person in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she was on the show with Marie for that one. So we probably,
oh, wonderful. She's yeah. great. She's a great writer.
We may have a podcast of that somewhere on the website.
Excellent.
So in closing, anything else for the writers listening? Any advice or pearls of wisdom to help the memoirists? People.
As much as possible, don't focus on the final goal of, you know, getting the book published and having the New York Times rave over it and getting, you know, on bestsellers lists and that sort of thing, because that is very... there's no guarantee you can get that, no matter how good you are. I see lots of wonderful books that get overlooked, that don't get that kind of attention. And if the goal all along is to get that, you will have spent years and years and years and years only to be frustrated. But if you can spend your hour or two writing today and say, hey, I got some good words on the page. Maybe some are not so good, but I got some good words on the page. I was true to my vocation today. I'm going to celebrate that and high-five myself. That's where the joy comes, and the just sort of daily discipline, the quiet practicing of our craft. And if we do that enough and find enough joy in that, the rest comes in whatever form it comes or doesn't come in, but that joy can't be taken away from us. And I think that's the reason we write.
Mm. It's a great note to end on, Bernadette. Thank you so much for taking
Thank
this
you,
hour.
Barbara.
You're welcome. It was Bernadette Murphy. Her memoir is Harley and Me, Embracing Risk on the Road to a More Authentic Life, published by Counterpoint. That's all the time we have today. Come back next week. We'll have more writers on writing. Have a great week. Stay in the chair and get your own writing done.